We continue here our review of the debate over the distributive impact of the new rules governing landlord-tenant law. The first step in the argument consists of the assertion that the implied warranty of habitability will force landlords to do their moral duty, specifically to help out poor tenants. Three related propositions underlie this claim. First, justice requires that the living conditions currently endured by poor tenants in our central cities be improved. It's outrageous that tenants live in squalor, and we ought not tolerate such conditions in a civilized society. Second, it's argued that landlords should be responsible for that improvement. And third, it's claimed that the implied warranty of habitability will have the effect of forcing landlords to do their duty and improve the leased premises. Examples of this argument can be found all through the pertinent body of law. But it's especially common in the original judicial opinions that powered this transformation. A good illustration is Judge Bazelon's dissenting opinion in the 1952 case of Bowles versus Mahoney. On the question of who is financially responsible for the injury sustained by a tenant's guest as a result of some dangerous defect in the lease premises, Bazelon says rhetorically, upon whom is the loss to be placed more justly than upon the landlord? Upon the tenant, who, because of his poverty, risks his own neck to live in the house? Upon the tenant's equally poor guest, the mailman, the visiting nurse, etc.? Another frank statement of this perspective can be found in a letter written by Judge Wright, the author of the famous Javens opinion, to Professor Edward Rabin of the University of California at Davis. Rabin was writing an article on landlord-tenant law and had the temerity to write Judge Wright a letter asking him why he had adopted the extraordinary reforms he did in the Javens case. Wright begins his response by connecting the revolution in landlord-tenant law to other social movements of the 1960s, specifically the opposition to the war in Vietnam and the civil rights movement. Wright then goes on to provide a remarkably open statement about his own motivations. With reference to your specific question, I was indeed influenced by the fact that during the nationwide racial turmoil of the 60s and the unrest caused by the injustice of racially selective service in Vietnam, most of the tenants in Washington, D.C. slums were poor and black, and most of the landlords were rich and white. There's no doubt in my mind that these conditions played a subconscious role in influencing my landlord and tenant decisions. When I joined the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, it was my first exposure to landlord and tenant cases. I didn't like what I saw, and I did what I could to ameliorate, if not eliminate, the injustice involved in the way many of the poor were required to live in the nation's capital. I offer no apology for not following more closely the legal precedents, which had cooperated in creating the conditions that I found unjust. To repeat, latent in this letter are three propositions. First, justice requires that the living conditions currently endured by poor tenants be improved. Second, landlords should be responsible for that improvement. And third, the implied warranty of habitability will have that effect. Now, one might challenge this set of assertions on several alternative grounds, and each of these arguments has been made frequently in the past. First, some critics argue that the tenants themselves are at least partially responsible for the poor conditions of their housing, and therefore it's not necessarily true that justice requires that someone improve those conditions. A second, more popular argument is the claim that landlords are not the class who should be responsible for the improvement in housing conditions. They're no more to blame for the tenant's poverty than the grocer who sells them food. Who should be responsible? Well, if anyone, it should be society at large, through the welfare system, in other words, through monies collected through general taxes. And the loss associated with improving housing conditions should not be imposed exclusively upon the landlords. The third criticism of this set of arguments is the claim that the implied warranty of habitability will not have its supposed effect. In other words, it will hurt tenants rather than help them. The first two of these arguments are interesting and important, but they would take us far afield of the topic of law and economics. For our purposes here, we are going to concentrate on the third of these claims, which is strongly associated with the methodology of law and economics. So specifically, stage two of the debate will take up this argument. The argument that the implied warranty of habitability won't do what it's supposed to do, namely, improve the lot of poor tenants.